This episode of the Deck Tees Podcast is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Become a part of their customer rewards program when you make any purchase and receive discounts on all future orders. That is CoolStuffInc.com. Episode 93 of the Deck Tees Podcast. I am Erin Campbell. My guest today is somebody that I affectionately refer to as the Diane Fossey of Magic. She is also my unofficial PR representative for the show. She is my dear friend, Adrienne Reynolds. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm Stalking Tiger. Everything is okay.
Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
It is my pleasure, and thank you so much for helping me out by having me on the show.
Absolutely. Now, the last time you were on, we got a little carried away.
You know, we hadn't met in real life the first time I was on. So part of that was we had communicated a lot of different ways, but I think that was actually our first time speaking to each other, because before you, I did not Skype. Mm-hmm. So I think it was, you know, like best camp pen pals getting together.
Right, and that's really what it is. Like, you know, a lot of the reason why I do this show is because I want to get to know these people. You know, I'm not just after their followers. I'm not just interested in promoting them or promoting myself. It's people that I otherwise wouldn't get a chance to get to know because they're, quote unquote, above me. Like, if they're Hall of Famers, what are the odds I would ever run into John Finkel in a hallway and have an hour of his time? You know, but having a podcast lets me do that. And I certainly get along with all of my guests, but I really feel like with you, we hit it off so well that it just kept flowing, and it was all entertaining to me. And it was also when I had just started the show, so I didn't know a lot about editing. I didn't know what to cut. I didn't know how much to cut. I didn't want to insult you by cutting anything.
Yeah.
Not knowing at the time.
Complicated thing for that.
Right. Right. And not knowing that, you know, having to edit something is not personal. It's not a slight on the guest. So those were just things I didn't know at the time.
And
but,
it was my first podcast ever.
Right. So I think we both come along. Yeah. So I think we both come a long way where we can really make this a tighter, still fun, but just a smoother show.
Well, it's really interesting that I'm back here 2 years later. It's 2 years, and that's a really long 2 years. So I am, from back then and now, all of this ends up still being attached to trying to advocate for a team and coach-based way to play Magic. Mm-hmm. So I have not given that up. Nobody should ever think that that happened. But I had been to WotC. I had been with WotC to Gen Con when we did this the first time. Yes? No?
Yes, you have.
All right. So Aaron Forsyth and I had had a conversation, and he had brought up something to me about what would coaching mean at the elite levels. And I don't know if he was playing devil's advocate or not, but I immediately brought up golf because golf is really my go-to sport when I think of comparing individual competition to Magic. And I said, well, you know, obviously Tiger Woods fired all his coaches as soon as he won the Masters. And Aaron agreed with that at the time, but yeah, that's something to look at. But he really started me down a path, and I realized I didn't actually know enough about elite coaching. I had really been focused on a model of little league community coaching. How do you teach people who didn't intend to be coaches to be coaches? So I was already kind of in that direction, but because of Aaron's question about elite coaching, I went and took at college a coaching and philosophy class. So when taking the coaching and philosophy class, I was developing all of this other academic work that I was planning on doing, heading towards a doctorate in anthropology and computer science. And studying real coaching, studying how the philosophy of coaching class takes it all the way from the Boy Scout leader who's just coaching people in dodgeball all the way up to, you know, Olympic coaching and World Series coaching and that sort of thing. And we had people come in who were actually those coaches. And the staff was great. They actually knew that I was coming in to apply it to Magic. So they spent time with me to talk about our culture and our environment and what would apply and what wouldn't and what I might not know that would, you know, inform that. So that was a huge cultural exchange. And one of the things I really learned there, and it feeds into what I'm doing now, is no matter what you play, let's say it's basketball, if there's a pickup game, your pickup game is influenced by the rules of the sport at the organized play level, not the professional level. That's a mistake that people make because we know pros. It's actually organized at the organized play level. Each division has its own rules. The rules create the culture for what's valued, not just inside, not just behaviorally, but also what's valued in style of play. Mm-hmm. And that became a question I really became fascinated with in Magic, because you know that when we first started, and I'm very much still on that learning curve, I was all like, I'm only playing standard. I can only understand one of these ways to play at a time. and that ended up not being practical if I wanted to be involved with people I loved who played the game. So I had to learn Commander, and I had to learn how to draft, and I had to learn, I didn't have to learn Play Chase. but each of those very much reacts to organized play. Mm-hmm. So these are questions that were floating, and I've been trying to, actually for a year, I've still actually been trying to work out, how do I formalize this so that we can start a discussion about coaching and team-based leagues in Magic? So I've been really low-key. I haven't been promoting anything because I've been gathering information. Then I got accepted to a really good school. Mm-hmm. So I'm at Bryn Mawr now, and I am actually on track to get a new undergrad and eventually move over to a doctorate. And I am an anthropology undergrad, which means that my work as an undergrad would normally be very small, but I'm also kind of old for an undergrad. And the work that I need to have done before I do research when I get to not be an undergrad anymore, it ends up that methodology to do it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So then I looked around and went, how do I get this done? What's as complicated as what I eventually want to do with as many different people and interests and classes and concepts and an organized system that gives out information? And ta-da, Magic! So now I'm going to be doing a 3.5-year field work ethnography of cultural actors in Magic the Gathering players. And I'm announcing it here with you.
Yay.
Like it officially starts when this airs, the field work part.
Okay, so break this down a little bit for me. So you're doing this study, and your goal is to, correct me if I'm wrong, your goal is to sort of identify what we all have in common despite our different formats and play styles and lifestyles, and you're hoping to do it through this?
So that's actually a little broad. You can't like that. So let's go back to Diane Fossey. When Diane Fossey wanted to go study primates, she's a primatologist, and that can be a form of anthropology, she had to circle around the edge. And she had to wait, and it's day 27, and I believe that they are actually approaching me and patting my hair. And then by day 147, they have accepted me as one of their own. Then
which sounds a lot like Magic. When you're a lady player trying to get into Magic, that's very similar.
Yeah, it's like an outsider player, right? Like if you're not what the marketing demographic is. So that's one of the really big things. When you have a capitalist-owned entity, like, we love Magic, but let's be real, that's what it is. It's supposed to make money, but it's also got all of these things that are defined because of the need to sell it. And for a long time, and maybe even still now, they define it as a game, which doesn't have gender in the toy industry. However, their marketing department defined their target market, and they defined their target market as young males, mostly in the 15 to 25 age. And then once you've defined your target market, it becomes incredibly easy to overwrite or exclude things. So if you're outside a target market and you play the game anyway, the focus isn't going to be for you. So then you're a little bit outsider by accident. Oh, our game is all welcoming. And that might be very true and very open, but the reality is when you go to design it, when you go to draw it, when you go to create your OP for it, you're doing all of those things expecting that only people 15 to 25 who are male are going to be the people who are interested, and everybody else is gravy. Mm-hmm. So that's not a knock at marketing. That's a reality of marketing. The same way you just asked me, so you're going to do this and it's going to be really broad, and I can't do that either for research. You have to walk into research with at least a thesis, if not a hypothesis. So anthropology is less insistent on a hypothesis. I don't have to have a theory that I'm trying to prove is true when I start, because anthropology is literally an observational study. Anthropology is the study of interactions of humans and power systems, exchange of power. Power can be information. Power can be goods or food. Some power is equally shared. Some power is hierarchical. Some power is transitional. All of those things. And all of those things are true in magic. Magic by itself is an extremely rich culture. So inside the magic community, all of those power structures can exist. So my practical field study is to just be in the environment. But unlike Diane, I do not have to hover at the edge and try to learn magic and figure out whether or not the natives will accept me. I'm something called a native participant observer. You can tell because I'm talking to you on video with a stalking tiger on my shoulder. Can't get more native than me. And you can be an activist and be an anthropologist, because anthropology is not like Star Trek. You don't have the prime directive. You do have a whole series of ethics, but the ethics all fall on me. I am not obligated to involve other people in my ethics. So for instance, one of the things that's going to happen is obviously there'll be a bunch of writing about this. Mm-hmm. I'm doing 3 years of this. If nothing else, I'm going to have a book at it at the end. I'm going to be spending 3 years interacting with real live human beings, and I'm going to be writing about them in aggregate, sometimes in specific. So one of the things that I'm going to do, and you know that I asked you this question too, what would you like your pseudonym to be, is I am actually going to use pseudonymous anonymity. There have been other field studies in gaming communities, such as World of Warcraft or something called there.com, where there are actually refugees from one gaming world who've diasporaed out into other gaming worlds. It's super cool. So I'm going to be using those ethical standards that have been used in, I'm going to use the term until I've got a better one, sort of mixed world gaming, physical world, virtual world, social world. There are bigger, fancier academic words that we don't need because it's confusing enough.
So you're going to be observing people. You're going to be observing players.
I'm a participant observer. So
okay.
While I'm there doing the things, everybody should just know I'm going to go home and I'm going to keep a diary, and someday some academic person is going to read about how I got raffle stomped by pack rats someday.
Now, is this something that you're able to achieve just by going to different events, like going to an S&M, going to a PTQ, going to a GP, or is this something you need to be closer to the people to do?
Well, so the part that I've already started, the part that's not the formal field study, the part that's actually just being a participant observer. So Diane Fossey is in with her primates, and they have accepted her as one of her own. Their own.
This really is a great metaphor.
It is, and thank you so much, because it really does make it accessible, and it also it removes it from human communities, because one of the big deals in anthropology is colonialism. We all walk in with our own biases, so you can never not live your bias. And I will have a website that everybody can go to, and I'm going to actually post, because right now at this point in time I believe in absolute transparency for this community. I'm going to post the proposal that I put in to make sure that I met the ethical standard, and there will be something in it called researcher positionality. And researcher positionality tells you exactly who I already am in this culture. So nobody's going to have to guess what bias I come in with if they want to know more about me, which is a little scary. You know me. I've never been this public on the Internet as I'm going to be for this. But I think it's only fair to the community. I don't have real authority. I'm just an observer. And it's not like I'm going to stop dissing planeswalkers just because I'm an ethnographer now. I am allowed to have an opinion as long as I make it clear I have an opinion. And I may take an extra step and go, and just because I'm doing this doesn't mean I have any special authority. I have special authority because I'm amazing.
That's now, I do want to build off of that for a second, because you said something very interesting, and I kind of want to tie that into something else we talked about earlier. You said something along the lines of you didn't necessarily have the authority. And you know, with all due respect, you and I are not the best players, so we're not pros.
Correct.
We're not people who would normally command the respect from others, or that people would normally, you know, take notice or defer, I guess, awesome to. That's the wrong word, but how do you think that's going to affect your interactions, that we, you know, you are a woman, which is still, unfortunately, a minority in this community, and you're not somebody who's technically noteworthy. Do you think that those two things might make people open up more to you, or do you think they might make people more closed to you?
I think what they do is they make me a real participant. In other words, I'm not an outsider. I am a person who goes to GPs. I am a person who I think actually qualified for World Magic Cup qualifiers again. So I'm literally in the middle of the skill set. The places that I have expertise are different than the places that I would have authority. For instance, I do the art reviews. I have an art background. I have a trained art background. And more importantly, everyone is still actually entitled to their opinion. You know, and you're right. You have actually come to me and said, hey, Adrian, what's the best way to phrase that? Because you also know that I have some public relations background. So we all come to magic with our own set of expertise. And this just makes me another person in magic. With all of the rights, responsibilities, and soapboxes that come with that. So that's the part that's the same. The part that's different is I do actually have a thesis that I'm looking at. And in this case, it may be less of a thesis and more of a question. Hey, Adrian, why are you doing this study at this time? Part of it's to develop a methodology, which you guys don't need to worry about unless you want to ask me about it over coffee sometime. But the part that I'm asking for magic, the part that matters for magic, is a formal research question. So I'm going to read it so I don't screw up my own stuff,
okay.
Which is, how do cultural actors with self-chosen identity based around an activity, in this case magic, reciprocally exchange information and values with each other? So that would be you and me and John Finkel and, you know, Darwin Castle and the guy that we play with at our FNM. So that's the reciprocal exchange. So we exchange with each other and with the corporate organized play entity providing and actively crafting the activity that provides our identity.
Okay.
So our identity is magic players.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that I'm asking is, how do we exchange value? So not values. It's not like, you know, Family for America or anything like that. How do we exchange value with each other? So a lot of magic players are very familiar with the concept of EV, expected value. And there is a tendency, especially among the type who are very financially oriented, to make EV specifically quantitative monetary EV or quantitative mathematic strategic EV. But there are other EVs, and those lead to things like plane chase or things like commander. Reciprocal is very important. That study of power structures is about exchange.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have power unless people give you power. You can't share power unless you all actively claim power. We do that in magic in a thousand different ways. And there's lots of writing about formal play in the DCI, and I will participate in that, and that is all part of it. But I need to actually ask questions that I wouldn't ask just as a player, and I need to be places that I wouldn't be just as a player. So this is the couch surfing for science part.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you a question. So I just want to make sure I understand what you said correctly. So give me an example of a way that I might reciprocate value or I might add value to the mix.
You add value. You're the reason I'm here, actually. Like, literally, this is why this is actually a formal part of my methodology submission is I will go on a podcast to try to reach the people that I might not reach otherwise. The value you add is exactly what we were talking about at the beginning. The people you're interested in interviewing, you're interested in interviewing them because they're interesting, not just because they've got the best deck. You know, we've talked about a deck list and I've got one for you, but, but you know, why you play, how you play, what are you doing as a person? Where does magic fit in your life? If I did have a thesis, my thesis would be the people who listen to Erin are people who are interested in big parts of the game, not just the technical details of the game. So what I'm really hoping is this. My first field site is an invitation to stay with a community manager, and I will be living in that person's house for an indeterminate period of time, partially to learn what I learn just by getting inside the primate group. but it's a primate group that's literally the other side of the country from where I am. And so it's basically, she said, yeah, sure, I'll do this. Come be an ethnographer on my couch. And I'm like, well, you know, ethnographers at this particular point in time with no outside funding are starving undergrad students. What can I offer you? What can I offer in exchange as a methodology to offer back to the community that I am asking to be a part of? And what I can offer is this. If you invite me anywhere as a member of the magic community, I will come be an ethnographer on your couch. In exchange for having an ethnographer on your couch, and it can actually just be your couch, but it's even better if you have a spare room. But I'll have a sleeping bag, and I can do that too. In exchange for having an ethnographer on your couch, I will play magic with you. Mm-hmm. I will be a story you can tell at parties. And I am a very, very good cook. So if you bring me to your house and let me be your ethnographer, I will cook for you. If you have childcare, I will help you with the kids and I will play magic with you.
I'm still waiting for your challah French toast, by the way.
Well, you've been in Philly twice, and you keep staying with Jeff.
I know. And she's very possessive, though.
Yeah, I know she's very possessive. I mean, and the thing is that, like, it's an hour schlep to get to meet from Jen, so.
Yeah.
However, you can have me as an ethnographer on your couch. I can watch you be Erin for a period of time.
You might not want to see me be Erin.
I might want to see you be Erin very, very much, because here's the thing. You do a lot of things. So this is the magic identity part, right? Mm-hmm. You happen to play fairly well. You play better than I do, I'm pretty sure, based on your results. Mm-hmm. But your magic identity is not exclusively as a player. Your magic identity is as a podcaster. Mm-hmm. So if I'm sitting on your couch, when you are not playing magic is just as important to me as when you are playing magic. I'm not just interested in how you play the game or who you play the game with. I'm actually interested in, you've invited me in because you feel like your identity in the magic community is strong enough to identify that way and get an ethnographer. Hey, that's cool. Where does that identity fit with you? And it's not going to be 100% of the time. It's not only when you go to FNM. It's going to be times when you're prepping for your podcast or times when you're trying to ask who to ask. I'd be interested in things like when does Erin decide that she's going to actually put out a call on the internet versus when is she following up her own leads? And then I'm going to take all of that information down. And then when I write about you later, I'm never actually going to identify all of that. Hopefully I will have been invited to several other podcaster couches or you will have introduced me to other people in your community, and they're like, hey, I'll take your ethnographer for a day or two of playing magic and cooking for me. and what that's called is embodiment. So we have to go back to anthropology terms just really quickly, which is embodiment is sometimes you embody a person. Diane was embodying one of the primates, even though she was not normally a primate. She put herself physically in that situation and embodied it to experience it. anthropology is a direct experience observation a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And then, so that's embodying the population. But I already embody the population, so I can't do that. Then there's other forms of embodiment called follow the artifact, go wherever the artifact goes. So one possible way some other ethnographer who is not me could do that is, I'm going to embody this mox. Let's make it a mox jet. I'm going to follow everywhere. I'm going to go to every physical location and player that this mox jet ever had contact with. And I'm going to do my ethnography that way. So that's follow the artifact. And then there's something called follow the ritual. Follow the ritual is, I'm specifically interested in seeing what I can see about F&M. So I am going to spend 3 years going to F&Ms in 16 countries and doing a cultural cross-comparison. Mm-hmm. So that's follow the ritual. Those are all very established things to do. I'm trying to do something new and weird. This is my senior thesis part. I am going to try to follow the path of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So this is the part that's all me. What I would like to do, and it goes back to the coaching and teaching, is how do we share the game with each other? How do we teach new people the game? How do we find people to play with? Because the biggest problem I ran into when I was really looking at team lead coaching, and I'm sure Wizards has it too, is the geography problem, the physical geography problem. So if you want to invite me to your couch because you're somebody who still identifies as a magic player, but you're in an environment where you can't play magic, I want to be on your couch too.
And just to clarify, you mean can't play at all. You mean it's not like they have the cards and they have people, they just don't like the people. You mean they have no outlet whatsoever.
Some people have no outlet. If you can't play because your environment is hostile or you don't enjoy it, that counts for me too. There are no quantifications. I have on the list of people who have already invited me two couches. One of them is actually, interestingly, the spouse of a magic player.
Mm.
That spouse identifies as part of the magic community. The spouse does not play.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that for a minute, because, you know, a lot of like, oh, are you going to go like stay with the pros? And originally I thought, oh no, I really want to get in deep to the people who might not be connected to the DCI, because I can be with the pros at, you know, GPs and stuff. And then I realized that's stupid. Mm-hmm. I am occasionally guilty of stupid. and it's really the spouse question. It was the same aha moment from Aaron Forsythe's question about the elite. Why am I limiting it? There's always the danger of limiting. Why am I going to predetermine that the kind of players I need to hear from are only X kind of players? So you need to know, the world needs to know, this is open. If the only thing you do with magic is sort cards, but you love sorting cards enough that that's your identity, and you would go on Twitter and go, I'm sorting cards. I love magic. I will come be your ethnographer on your couch, cook for you, help you take care of your kids, and, you know, be part of your card sorting world. If you are an artist for magic, either professional or somebody who does altars, or somebody who just makes fun things for your friends, like, you know, in our D&D groups, we used to have people come by and they just like do character sketches of all of our characters, even though they didn't play. If there's anything like that in magic, if you invite me anywhere in the world and I can get there, I will go.
Mm-hmm. So I want to move on to something else I'm curious about. So we've talked a lot about why you're doing this. The question I have now is, why do we need this? Or what do you think that we, the community, or we, the people you're studying, what are we getting out of this?
Well, we do have a lot of, we're people who see patterns. We're very good at seeing patterns. So there's all sorts of, and, you know, we love a good spoiler season and guessing things. But one of the things that I realized when I came back to Magic the first time is I was being told a lot of things about people, that there's this whole mythology of who's playing, who's not playing, And then you and I know, because you're in this little backside network of ladies who play MTG. I have met more women my age who play and become really good friends with than I did doing anything else, including being in the PTA. So there's an entire unobservable group of people who are going in and playing. And when I started looking at numbers, I realized the DCI is huge now. But if I'm being really, really generous, and it would be really generous, and the numbers that I have will be up on the website, but if I'm really generous, 10% maybe of the players would be in the DCI. And that's hugely generous. Like, it's probably actually more single numbers. At the last time that WOTC was able to publish numbers, and there's lots of reasons they don't publish numbers now, but at the last time, they estimated 12 million players and fans in 2009. And at that same time, they had gotten a better computer system, and they were able to create a definition of an active player. So an active player was somebody who had participated in a formal event in the last 12 months from that point, and that was 300,000-ish. The number of active players was 135,500 players in 2009. And that's big. That's huge. Now, think about how much we've grown just in the past 3 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're humongous now. GP Vegas wasn't a blip. It was a warning.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's huge. And when you grow that fast, that means whatever your assumptions were about your market or your community or your target, this is rapid change. Not everybody who's doing this now is the same. The thing that Magic will get is the methodology is about how do you take a snapshot of an entire huge complex society to create a baseline for that culture that other people can add to. Mm-hmm. So Magic is going to be the place where I experiment with creating a shareable format for that. What we'll get out of it, though, is we'll get a look at not just people who are off the grid, but the question is really, how does organized play affect those people, or maybe us people, and how do we affect organized play? Mm-hmm. Because one of the things is always, you know, the best way to have a conspiracy theory is to guess. Oh, I think they're really looking for this. This is actually a way for the people who aren't visible. And the internet, by the way, is huge for this. Like, you're part of that visibility standard, right? Mm-hmm. If you find somebody who's doing something cool, like the gentleman who runs the children's group, or Nate Holt did the Abington Friends group. Yeah. Those are people who are not playing DCI or may not be playing DCI, and they get exposure because we are networking with each other. And when we network with each other, we create community. And because we are now something that can be seen, the designers know that that group of people exists. And then we don't become a theory. Commander is a fan-based creation of how to play that had enough groundswell that it created product to support it. Goes both ways. And some of it's, you know, my work with Planeswalkers for Diversity. What are the standards by which we treat each other? That's hardcore cultural anthropology. And yes, actually, anthropologists work to identify things. Maybe things are or aren't a problem. Maybe things are a response to some other cultural pressure. I won't have answers for any of that, but I'll have descriptions of them. And the descriptions can let other people talk about answers. Mm-hmm. And that's as much as I'm going to be able to do in 3 years. And I don't know what's going to happen after 3 years. But the thing that I'm really looking for is this. We are a community that chooses each other. We are a community that voluntarily changes the nature of our culture every 3 months. Mm-hmm. How can you not be excited about figuring that out? How can you not be excited about watching Mike Linneman respond to art each release? Mm-hmm. And then watch people respond to Mike Linneman. I never like went crazy over a card other than Creepy Doll. And I went crazy over Creepy Doll enough that I had Matt Stewart sign my Creepy Dolls. But I didn't go crazy enough over Creepy Doll to build one or have one commissioned built. But Therese Nielsen's Stocking Tiger, all of a sudden, baby, I need a Stocking Tiger. I need five of the card. I need people better than me to help me build decks. And the way that you're actually going to be able to find me at large events is I will have a physical Stocking Tiger with me. Mm-hmm. So you can come invite me to your couch at an event.
Very nice. So you brought up Wizards a couple times throughout the episode. Do they know about this? Do they have a hand in this at all?
So Wizards is the one that actually invited me the first time to speak to them, which meant that my interaction with Magic is never touched without thinking of them. And I have immense respect for what they do. And also, it's very important to me for the big fancy field work that I'm not going to bother you about on your podcast. But there's something called studying up. So it's not just studying the people who are responding to the product. It's also studying, hopefully, with their cooperation at some point, I would like to be able to be an ethnographer on WotC's couch. Any version of WotC's couch is fine, and I did contact them to let them know I'm doing it, because the other problem is that's 3 years. So there's lots of types of ethnography where you fall off the map and become invisible. This is going to be the opposite, because we communicate with each other so much through media. There's no way for me to stay anonymous. There's also an ethical requirement. I have to tell people that I'm doing an ethnographic study. Even if I were in the middle of a volcanic tribe that was deep in the volcano that had fire-resistant skin and they'd never heard of humans, I would be ethically obligated to try to explain to them what I was doing so that they would have the opportunity to go, I don't want to be in the report. And that's valid. And if you actually say to me, I don't want to be in your report, I will still end up taking my own field notes. You can't actually erase my experience. It's
right.
Like a jury instruction. But what I can promise you is nothing about you or any interaction I observed with you will ever see print or press. Mm-hmm. Or a classroom discussion. None of it will happen. That's part of my ethical burden. If you say what you're doing is cool or what you're doing is a tool of the devil, but either way, I don't want to be involved, that's awesome. You can't actually kick me out of a space, per se, because, you know, I'm still a native participant observer, and usually there'll be public spaces. And sometimes it'll be, like, me just making sure. But, yeah, so I want to study. It's called studying up when you study the people who have the power. If I were doing it for software technology, studying up would be studying the corporation or studying developers. Studying up in this case would be studying people who work with WotC, the WotC communication thing. I contacted Organized Play, and I got a really helpful, enthusiastic, responsive email back that I hadn't answered yet, because the questions that I was asked were ones I had to think about. And what I realized is when I study up with WotC, I don't want WotC because they have the power. I don't want WotC's take on things influencing my interpretation of being on the couches of the world. But I would love to be able to have that information and study up back. So I thought originally I was going to like apply for an internship or something and hopefully get in, or work for free, or be an ethnographer in their corner or something. And I was going to try to do that next summer. But now I've decided I'd rather do the couch surfing part of the ethnography first, and then work with WotC to see what's the best way to study up with them. This is
Do you think they're willing to work with you?
What?
Do you think they're willing to work
yeah.
with you on this?
Yeah, I have some indication that they're willing to work with me.
Okay, because I know from the times we talked, it was like, you know, I kind of got the impression that, like, you know, they were kind of just sort of smiling and nodding, like, but, you know, they weren't telling you no, but they also weren't giving you a yes either.
I understand that part of being an anthropologist is not asking permission.
Sure.
It's not the same as, I'm not going to be performing any experiments. It's an academic term called deception, and very much like the word cheating in the magic judging community. It's a heavy, heavy loaded word when it goes outside of its academic format. But the idea is, like, if you're doing a sociology experiment, like let's say OKCupid, I'm going to go on OKCupid and be a different gender.
Oh,
that's
Lord.
Like, that's for academic purposes.
Yeah.
Right? For that first person experience that you won't have. And let's be real. A lot of people don't get it until they experience it. We can complain about it, but it will still be true. So every 5 weeks, somebody's going to do, you know, a little junior undergrad sociology experiment where they present themselves as something other than they are. Anthropology is literally the opposite of that. That's why I've got a website. That's why I'm going on the podcast. So you don't ask permission because you're just going to be there anyway. Which is why you get, like, wiggle words from me. I don't need WOTC's permission to do an academic study. I do, however, want to study with that community rather than study, like, I would rather be doing, and I am definitely, the information that I'm getting, like, how do you go deep? How do you network with this group of people? If I'm sitting on the spouse's couch and the spouse is like, hey, we're going to go cube at my friend's house 45 minutes away. And then I go with the person to the cube. And then at the cube, somebody goes, hey, you're really cool. You know what? We're going to go play with another group that I play with over at this little shop, but they're not DCI registered, another 25 minutes away. So that's a pattern. There is no physical way for me to come out of 3 years without a lot of information that's useful to WOTC. And I do wonder about that, but I don't know what that looks like or what sharing that looks like. But I am open to sharing it because one of the reasons I'm doing it is because I love this community and want to give back to it. So they're helping me, absolutely. This will create something to do something much bigger. But I want to be able to give it back to them. So I'm going to be as transparent as I can to share all of this information simultaneously. And once I finish this summer and I understand what actually being on couches means and what kind of information I get, that's when I'm going to probably go back and follow up that email and not release the name of the person who sent me the email. Because, yeah, it's not enough. We are not a community if we're just the players. We are not a community if we're just the artists. We're all of these things together. But my focus on WOTC is actually very specific. My focus on studying up in WOTC is only organized play. Mm-hmm. That does end up including all of WOTC, but it's from the focus of organized play, which is a very different focus than we usually look at. Usually we look at the game design does this. And I'll be looking at how does game design affect organized play. So mm-hmm. It's all about organized play.
Right. So with that said, what can we do for you? What can we do to help you with this as the players, as the community? Aside from the couch, and giving you a place to stay.
This summer, I learn how to do field work. Understand, okay. I'm an undergrad. Understand that I'm learning as I go too, which is the other reason that I think transparency to the community is very important. I created a Tumblr because I love you all so much. I'm going to follow the best practices used in an ethnographic study of a Second Life, where the anthropologist created a space called Ethnographia, and you went to go meet him, so you always knew you were talking to an ethnographer. I don't know what I'm doing about funding right now. The thing I'm afraid of is that it's very easy to exploit what I'm doing for marketing in ways that I might not approve of. So keep an eye on me. I'm exploring ethical methods of having a community funded. And also, I'm exploring the ideas of participatory communal study. I tell you I'm an ethnographer, you community. And the community comes back to me and goes, an ethnographer is cool. We'd like to own our own information. So So what do we, so that's reciprocal. It's reciprocal exchange. Mm-hmm. If you guys need anything from me, ask me. I'll go on podcasts. I'll write for you if I can. You know, the times that are actually semester schools are going to be lower participation. But one of the really cool things about following the path of knowledge is, let's say I got that offer to Cube 45 minutes away and school starts the next day. It's not a broken connection. I can actually pick that up when I have time again from the same point and continue following that path of shared knowledge. Mm-hmm. The other thing I realized last weekend following the methodology of if you ask me to do anything with magic, I will do it. I was teaching magic at a Comic-Con, and I realized that me, sending me somewhere to teach somebody is another path of sharing the game. It's another way that people learn how to play the game. So I'm literally physically embodying the game. So you can pretty much, what you can do for me is ask me to do things and I will do them. And support, suggestions, the vocal members of Magic community are very, very vocal. Share information with your friends who are not. All of you know somebody who's off the magic grid. Mm-hmm. Ask them if they'd be interested in having an ethnographer who will keep them anonymous, whenever. There is a caveat. If I end up speaking to like a Richard Garfield level person, or if, you know, Mark Rosewater, I don't know why he would invite me to his couch, but if Mark Rosewater invites me to his couch, there will be people that I will be interacting with that will be so big, people in the community will know who that is. And even 4 years later when I publish, they'll be able to go, oh, Adrian's talking to Marrow then. So some people are famous enough that I can't actually. Like when I do this, it will really be a question when I write about this podcast. How famous will you be in 4 years? If you're super, super famous by that point, I'm not going to be able to necessarily, I can probably hide your identity for the greater population, but I might not be able to hide your identity. I wouldn't be able to hide your identity in group.
Well, there's also a lot of identifying factors that are like purely me where you'll be doing your field log and you'll be like, you know, subject just told burn prayer they could crack teeth on popcorn kernel. They're going to be like, that's Erin. That's our girl.
So that's how anthropology writing works, though, right? So my journal will go, crazy red-haired lady told opponent on full tilt because she cracked teeth on a popcorn kernel. And what will happen when I write about it academically is food and violence metaphors during tilt are fairly common. Choke on a dick, crack your teeth on popcorn.
Go down a hot metal sign on a summer day. Sure.
do you want some marshmallows to toast over that burn? Food analogies will be there. That will be written about. Your name will, and the circumstances other than tilt would never be in that paragraph. So it won't be, so nobody has to worry about that. Nobody's going to get outed by the professional writing. because they'll be written in aggregate. What will happen is if somebody challenges my conclusions, they would go back to my field notes. My field notes will have nothing but pseudonyms or possibly numbers in them. So instead of crazy red-haired lady, it might be you guys are called informants because you're informing me. You are not subjects. Participant informant on tilt. Participant informant number 132 said crack your teeth on a popcorn kernel. I'll know who it is. Everybody who listens to this podcast will know who it is.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is something I'm very curious about because it's actually something that has stopped me from doing something similar to this. Because one of my very best friends, he is into something called Couchsurf.com.
Oh, really?
It's an actual website where you can sort of travel the country and instead of staying at a hostel or instead of staying at a hotel, you can stay on someone's couch. And it's like Yelp in a lot of ways where you put your home up there, you put your accommodations up there, like this is my couch, this is what it'll look like, this is where you can stay, this is the times you can come and go as you please, these are the pets that I have, and then people review them, like, hey, I had a really great time at this place's house or person's house.
Great couch.
serious. That's some of the feedback that people leave, or they will say things like, oh, this person hung out with me, or this person made me soup, and it's an actual website. But one of the things that stops me from using something like that is the safety factor, where I worry about, do I know these people? Like, what happens if I go and it ends up being sort of some sort of Saw situation where, you know, it's a trap and I'm having to answer questions and, what are you thinking in terms of safety? Like, are there any precautions you're taking?
Actually, it's not like I haven't thought about it at all, but let's take a look at some of the groups that I now know exist in Magic as part of the community that I didn't know existed before I even started doing this ethnography. So I've been in for years and years, and I didn't know these groups of people existed. Somebody told me about Magic Cam Girls.
Yeah.
And, oh my God, I would love to be on a Magic Cam Girls couch. Mm-hmm. Because that's somebody who's really associated, that's, not all of the cultural actors in Magic are legal cultural actors, and not all of the cultural actors in Magic are things I even know about. So that kind of goes back to that, what can you do for me? If you know something that's happening in the Magic community, and it's not on the little Venn diagram that's going to be on the website, or you think I don't know about it and I should, find me on Twitter, find me on Tumblr, find me on Facebook, and tell me about it. I would love to be there. But you're right, there is safety. Like, one of the groups of people I would love to be able to find are the people who are doing the small-scale counterfeiting, because they're not going to be in it for the money. So what is their connection to the – you have to know the community for counterfeiting. But that could be dangerous. Like, I don't know what that is. I spent a lot of this year studying Brazil, and I know in Brazil – there are Magic the Gathering players who use the online tool specifically to make a living. That would be a target group where I would love to have an invitation to spend time with any group. I know they do it in Brazil, but I'm sure that they do it in other places in the world. And that means that I will be a person traveling alone to strange places in the world. And that's okay. Part of anthropology is risk. If I were going to a tribe that lived inside a volcano, I could die there. I know that sounds kind of freaky to say out loud, but
I think even Diane Fossey, unfortunately, was killed during her work.
I don't remember because I'm not a primatologist, but there's a fairly high chance. Also, she was doing it for a really long time. You can slip actually with a very peaceful group of people, but they climb mountains and you lose your footing and you can die. I can also die on the way to school. I can choke while I'm cracking my teeth on a popcorn
maker. You don't play Burn. That doesn't apply to you.
Well, I play Riddick Wins, which I know you. I like blowing things up and making lots of dudes. Let's not lie. I love tokens and I love blowing things up. But, that's real. And I have a couple of thoughts, but I need to balance them. My safety is secondary, really, to the privacy and ethics of the people that I would be staying with. So one of the things I was thinking of is like a where in the world map, like where in the world is Adrienne and her stalking tiger? and some of it is, if you're inviting me, the invitations can be very public. So like if you're inviting me through Twitter or you're inviting me through Tumblr, or I don't know how Tumblr works, but I'm sure it can happen. Any of the connections that we get, but I'm not 24 years old. I'm not a young person kind of wandering around the world randomly into other people's couches. Part of it is also trust. Like, this is the MTG community. You guys do need to know that I have told Wizards I'm doing this.
Yeah.
Wizards knows I'm doing this. If you take me out, you're never going to get a promo card. the Judge community is there. One of the things I was thinking about is, if you invite me to your couch and the couch is not particularly safe for me, that's when I'll go back to my network of people that I'm friends with already in the community, the Judges community, you, and I will network among them. And I will still be your ethnographer, but I may stay on a couch nearby, because mm-hmm. The work's no good if it's not finished. Mm-hmm. And if I do the Carmen Sandiego map, I think what I'll do is I will note the location that I'm in. I don't at the moment see where I would get so deep that there wouldn't be internet connection. Mm-hmm. So I might do a ping, I'm okay, on Facebook or something. Mm-hmm. Community, I am completely open to suggestions so that my safety is something that's at least considered, and I'm not just throwing myself on random couches with no backup. Mm-hmm. So I am totally willing to crowdsource the safety issue. And just be aware. Yeah, I am actually aware that there is a safety and security issue, and that's a risk that I'm willing to take. I know it seems like it's a big risk for a game, but this isn't actually just about the game. This is about humans. Anthropology is the study of humans and being humans together. I trust this community enough to take the risk to try to work out how to do that here so that hopefully this work will be doing much bigger, more important work later. And it will always be because of the Magic community. And that's important to me.
Now, one thing I want to ask before we go, this sort of just came to me, and because this is my show, you know, I do look for those probing moments.
Okay.
What does your family think about this? Like, you're going to be gone for 3 years. I mean, have you thought about when you're going to see them? Are you going to maybe schedule some visits, or what are their thoughts on this?
Well, remember, I'm still an undergrad, so I have to come back for the school semesters.
Okay.
All right. So that's, you know, and I will not stop the ethnography. What I'm really doing is I prioritize things that I'm local to that I can do from my own couch mm-hmm. last. So I will not be working when I'm not traveling. And also remember, traveling costs money. So
yeah.
If I have no funding, I will eventually reach the end of my resources.
Sure.
Also understand that everybody in my family has been talked to death about what the big goal is.
So they're just pushing you out the door, like, go.
I am incredibly lucky that I have a very, very supportive family, and it would be impossible to do something. Like, you know me, I actually kind of like money and I'm pretty good at business. So I'm actually giving all of that up to do this research. MTG is the start of the research, but the long-term research, that was literally me going, oh, look at this entire life plan that I had that I could have actually executed and giving that up to do this research. So it's weird and we're negotiating it. But yeah, if I get a fellowship that like lets me travel around the world for an entire year, then we would deal with something where, like, you know, people would come visit me from my family. But I'm at a point right now where nobody in my family needs me this badly. It's a very fortuitous time. It's, you don't change the world by putting other people in your immediate family first all the time. And before I even accepted the attendance at Bryn Mawr, I'm like, you realize, like, when I say yes, that means that I'm doing this science research really forever. Like, I mean it. I'm willing to put this much of myself online, and it may mean traveling. It may mean grad school. Like, you know, this is 3 years where I travel back and forth, but what if I get into a doctoral program that's nowhere near my family? Like, that's, we'd have to have a long-distance relationship for that. Anthropology is about long-term study. It's never about I'm dropping in for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
If you're dropping in somewhere for 2 weeks, it's part of a larger study that takes more time, because the most important thing about anthropology is study over time. So we're all aware of the time. And I'm incredibly, incredibly grateful to Bryn Mawr for letting me use undergrad as a framework to do work that actually should be graduate work. They're being incredibly helpful, and that's kind of amazing too. So yeah, I've got support. I won't starve. I don't have a lot of extra money, but I'll have a food allowance. And I can cook for you. I'm a really good cook.
I know. I I'm still like, God, you know, I would probably invite you here just for the French toast.
If that's what gets me onto a couch that I would not get to normally, I am all about that. like seriously, I'm not lying. People who just cosplay Magic characters, although I know Christine Sprankle, for instance, does all the Magic things.
Oh yeah.
But maybe there's somebody who just makes Liliana veils. That'd be cool. Wouldn't you want to know that person's interaction with Magic?
Yeah.
That's and remember that the other thing it's just as important to me when you're not playing Magic as where you are. I think there's one other weird little thing that maybe we should talk about, because we're actually using this as a platform to get me into homes, which is, what does your ethnographer on your couch do when you have to go to work or something like that? So I've just described a whole bunch of stuff, but understand that when you're at work, I have a whole bunch of writing and researchy things on a computer that are going to be happening so that all of this makes sense, and I have to do that daily. So you do not have to entertain me. I'm like a pet tarantula, which is cool and really interesting to talk about at parties and sometimes a tiny bit creepy. If you invite me someplace and you can occasionally manage to get me into your workspace so I can at least see you in your workspace as well as in your magic space, that would be lovely, but not necessary. Mm-hmm. And I should probably tell people where I'm starting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I will be starting in Las Vegas.
Oh, my goodness. City of Sin.
And so right now I am scheduled. I took a one-way ticket to Las Vegas. I will stay as long as my informant host, who has been really loud on the internet about the fact that I'm going. So,
right?
Everybody knows where I'm staying. But, so if you are a community member anywhere in Vegas, just because I'm staying with one person, that's why I think the Carmen San Diego map will work, because if I tell you a location that I'm in, you'll know I'm around there to invite. So right now I think that looks like my best safety plan, but it also looks like my best opportunity for invitations. And you can be anywhere on the grid. You can be the most famous player in the entire world. You can be somebody who gets to play Magic once a year. You can be somebody who just has uncut sheets of Magic on your walls because you like the art. All of that counts.
So where can people find you? Is there a website for this? How can they get in touch with you? Let me know all of that.
So the website, which will hopefully be up by the end of this podcast going live. Please don't go too early. is mtganthropology.com.
Okay.
But I took the other versions of that .org/.net so that if anybody gets confused, so mtganthropology.com will have all of this stuff. I have a Tumblr. The Tumblr is Dreamtime Drin at Tumblr. I think it's also searchable by Old Lady Planeswalker. What else do I have? I have a special email just for this ethnography. So even if you know me, you can, if you want to make sure that it's Hey Adrian Ethnographer and not Hey Adrian, that will be Drinne, D-R-I-N-N-E, at me.com.
Okay.
So those are the Dreamtime Drinne is just me. I'm not separating that identity. I'm too embedded in the community. It seemed really stupid to make a separate ethnographic identity for participant observer. And this will be refined. After I'm done with this preliminary study, then I'll be doing maybe surveys. Maybe I'll have figured out short area visits. Those will be participatory. They get a different ethical standard than what I'm doing now. So they take time to develop. A lot of what I'm doing this summer is gathering enough information to be able to make the participatory stuff useful to both myself and the community.
Okay. Well, I have certainly enjoyed hearing about this, and I wish you well. And, if there's anything I can do, definitely let me know.
Okay. And can I put in a request?
Absolutely.
We talked about it offline, but I'm going to put you on the spot and hope you actually put it on the air.
I could take
it. Okay. I really wonder every single time you interview somebody about what their favorite decks are. And I want their favorite deck list. Not the best deck, not the most important deck. I want their favorite deck list. The one just make them smile.
Are you going to lead off? Are you going to give me your favorite deck?
I will give you my favorite deck. I didn't make it. I made it. I have a whole story that goes with it, which I could tell some other time. But I will give you my favorite deck is a Creepy Doll deck. That Aaron Forsythe actually made for Jonathan Coulton, because Creepy Doll is based on a song by Jonathan Coulton.
Yeah.
And I didn't know who Jonathan Coulton was. I loved Creepy Doll that much. Apparently not as much as I love Stalking Tiger, but really close.
You do know that Creepy Doll is my wallpaper on my computer.
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Creepy Doll is the best thing. So
it has been since Innistrad. I have not changed
because
it.
Because why would you? Because Creepy Doll.
Yeah.
So So I loved Creepy Doll so much that I was trying, like, with my little baby skill set to build a Creepy Doll deck. And my Creepy Doll deck was good because I put Olivia Valdarn in it because she had petticoats. She looked like the person who would commission Creepy Dolls to be made. Obviously, the Creepy Dolls belonged to Olivia. So, and I put in Bump in the... So the problem was I kept winning, but I kept winning before I could get my Creepy Dolls out, which made me really, really sad. Aaron Forsyth made a Creepy Doll deck for Jonathan Coulton, the writer of the song. Jonathan Coulton was so excited about it that he took pictures. He spread it out and took pictures of the deck. And I am so much of a Creepy Doll fangirl that I actually took the pictures and blew them up using my graphics software like CSI to see what they were and build the deck. But Jonathan Coulton had not posted the land. And so I actually, like, from Twitter, like, some little idiot went, are there lands with that? Were there any special lands, or is it just straight islands and swamps? And he answered me back, which gave me massive cred across my family, who were all, unbeknownst to me, massive Jonathan Coulton fans. So Jonathan Coulton helped me rebuild Aaron Forsyth's Creepy Doll deck, and I play it to this day. It is the best social deck. It doesn't win too fast like my Creepy Doll did. It's got Army of the Damned, so I have actually swung with 23 zombies. But what I found, one of the problems that I found was that as I was getting better at the game, it was harder and harder for people to play pickup games with me if they were playing decks that they brewed at home or casual decks. So what will happen is they'll ask me to play a deck of my own first. They'll almost always insist on playing against a competitive deck, which is sometimes good and sometimes not. I adjust afterwards, but if I think that they need to actually, like, just test their deck at their skill set, I play the Coulton's Creepy Doll deck because it's good enough to really be a good deck, but it's slow enough to let somebody else really explore their deck. So to this minute, I travel around with my Creepy Doll deck, and I still play it. When I'm out on the ethnography, I will have this Creepy Doll deck with me. How many different ways did Magic interact in order to have this be my favorite deck? How could this not be my favorite deck?
Well, you will have to certainly give me the deck list, and I will post it in the blog post that goes with this episode, and people can see the list, and if they really like it, they can pick up the cards from Cool Stuff and give it a go themselves.
Absolutely. And now that I've done that, you've got to get everybody else.
Right? Exactly. No, I'll definitely do that. I definitely want to try that, and I'm anxious to see what people, you know, what qualifies as someone's favorite.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming back to the show.
I'm always happy to talk to you.
And if anyone has enjoyed what they've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Please leave me a review and some stars, and of course, subscribe. You can follow the show on Twitter at the Deck Tees. You can follow me at Original Estrus. You can email the show at estrus@elitistjerks.com. That's my personal email. And if you are interested in being a guest on the Deck Tees, I am offering a slot to be interviewed on the show as part of the hashtag Team Panda Silent Auction. So if you want to be probed by me, that sounds a little wrong, I just realized that, put your money where your mouth is, give your money to a good cause, and you could be where Adrian is right now. I will be asking you questions. I will be promoting you. It's a pretty rare opportunity because I don't have just anybody on this show. So if you're listening, definitely consider that because I would love to get to know you. And, of course, please take care of yourselves, and I'll talk to you later. Bye.